Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We've got a history flavour to today's show. Our featured guest is James Boyce, talking about his book Imperial Mud, The Fight for the Fens. We'll also hear from Jane Taylor about her novel set in 19th century Cambridge. And Raphael Cormack will be talking to us about his book Midnight in Cairo, about the female stars of Egypt's roaring 20s. But first of all, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, James. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you, Lee. Now, it's a pleasure to be with you.
As I say, we've got a history theme. Was it always going to be history that was going to be your subject? I mean, I say history. I do note that you've got a PhD in geography and environmental studies as well.
Oh, yes. Now, I'm really a historian, but I did do my PhD just because there was a supervisor there who was interested in environmental history. A lot of my work is broadly environmental history, not so much what we do to the environment, but what the environment does to us. You know, I'm interested in people living in particular lands and how the lands make them.
And as people will no doubt be able to tell straight away from your accent, you're Australian. I'm speaking to you in Tasmania. You've written on Australian history. Why is an Australian interested in the fens?
Yes, it's a very good question, and one that I've asked myself. I can remember the beginning was when I was living in Norwich in the late 90s. I used to be a social worker, and I was working with elderly people in Norfolk. And I met a lot of country folk. Of course, I wasn't quite in the fens, but I was nearby, and I think it began my relationship with the country, and it began my reading of the history of the fens, and my own family story, I think, became increasingly important. I knew that my father's family came from Cambridgeshire, but I hadn't realised that they came from the heart of the fens. Probably mostly it was reading the history, Lee. As I was reading the history, it reminded me a lot of what the way the story, especially around the drainage of that wetland area, was being told, reminded me of, I mean, I'd been spending a lot of time, the last 20 years really, immersed in frontier history in Australia. So that whole encounter between British settlers and Aboriginal people has been my main area of study. I suppose what I brought to bear, what I could see, was a sort of that sensibility, that knowledge I'd had here. And I could see that I could look at what was going on in the fens, the drainage, and particularly resistance by local people to defending their land, defending their common, defending their way of life, defending their community. You know, resistance came in many forms, the same as it did here. I think that was really what motivated the book in the end, was that I felt like I had something important to say, something I wanted to say. Yeah.
And there is a James Boyce in the book. Is yes, he a relation?
I only discovered that really quite near the end. I came across as someone had written a PhD on the resistance to the drainage of Whittlesea Mere, which was probably the largest lowland lake in England before it was drained. And it was really the last big drainage project in the mid-19th century. In some ways, it marks the end of the old fens. But the sort of fight, if you like, for Whittlesea, the fight to defend the whole wetland area around the lake, the fight to defend the common, had really begun during the Civil War, a couple of hundred years in the mid-17th century. Heather Bolfe, from memory, had written her PhD on that, and I was reading the PhD and it was just full of voices, including a James Boyce who got Tower of London for his role in trying to stop the drainage and trying to stop what we call enclosure, which is the removal of the common rights, you know, effectively the privatisation of the land. Yeah, so that was quite a moment, especially given that my father's ancestors come from that sort of area. So I don't know if James Boyce was a relative. He may well have been. I like to think he was.
Well, we'll listen to your first choice of music in just a moment now. Is music important to you, James?
I love listening to music, but I don't know very much about it, Lee. I'm not one of those music buffs who know a lot, but I do listen to a lot of music. I listen to a lot of classical music and folk music, and there's certain old songs that I'm pretty dependent on, and some music that I can work to, some music I can't work to, like us all. But as a writer, we need our little breaks, you know, after an hour or two in front of the computer, I just need to ease off. And so quite often I'll just listen to a bit of music, try and sort of stand up, walk around a bit, and stay in the zone.
Yeah. So why this one, Down Under by Men at Work?
Oh, well, I just got this one because the first time I lived in England, I've lived in England a few times, have the good fortune to be married to an English woman, Emma. But the first time I went, I was only 18. I went off on a working holiday, first trip overseas, end of 1982 and through 1983, I lived in England. And Men at Work's Down Under became a bit of an anthem for young Australians in Britain and in Europe. I thought I'd kick off with that one.
Traveling in a freighter combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombies. I met a strange lady.
That was Down Under by Men at Work, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, James Boyce. James is a multi-award-winning historian. His first book, Van Diemen's Land, published in 2008, was described by Richard Flanagan as the most significant colonial history since The Fatal Shore. His follow-up work, 1835, The Founding of Melbourne and the Conquest of Australia, was the Age Book of the Year and shortlisted for numerous awards. Imperial Mud, The Fight for the Fens, which came out in paperback earlier this year, was longlisted for the RSL Ondaatje Prize and won the History and Tradition category at the East Anglian Book Awards. BBC Countryfile magazine called it a real page-turner, a warning about what happens when the rich and powerful dress up their avarice as progress, a lesson we could do with learning today. Well, I'll come back to that quote later, James. I really enjoyed the book as well. And living in Cambridge, we think we know where the fens are because we are surrounded by the fens. But for you, geographically, what area were you taking as Fenland? What are the fens for you? Where are they?
I included all the classic area that we usually refer to as the fens, you know, through northern Cambridgeshire and western Norfolk and for southern Lincolnshire, which is very important, all the area around Boston. But I also included what's sometimes called the Northern Fens, northern Lincolnshire and parts of Yorkshire around the Isle of Axholme and in that sort of area, because the history is so similar and overlaps. But I don't attempt to sort of do a very precise definition. I mean, I've got some maps in the book, but it's not a case of like a county border, is it, with the fens? It's more about an identity. You know if you're in the fens or if you know if you're not, but it has changed a little bit over time in the way that identities can. But the broad area of the fens is something that those living in the fens have always had a strong regional identity, as well as the county identity, as well as their parish identity, as well as their national identity. There's this regional identity which has been going on for centuries. That's the subject of my book, the old wetland area, more than a million wild acres. I mean, the last big lowland wilderness area of England, not just the last wild area in terms of landscape, but last wild area in terms of the people themselves.
And in terms of what it would have looked like, because of course we know it now because it's been drained, which is the story of your book.
Yeah.
But what would it originally have looked like if we'd have gone to the fens in the 17th century, say, or the 18th century? What would we have seen?
Yeah. Well, the drainage begins in the 17th century, but really not a lot until the sort of mid-17th century. And up to that time, what you would have seen in many parts of the fens for much longer after that, because the resistance to the drainage was so successful, which is often forgotten. I mean, the resistance to the drainage held back the drainage for over 100 years in southern Lincolnshire. And even within Cambridgeshire, the challenge involved with the drainage was so great that once the waters were banished, they'd often come back, both because of environmental reasons and also because of the popular resistance. What you would have seen would have depended on the season. The rivers, as you know, of central England flow into that vast lowland area before they reach the wash. So the gradient becomes very low. And the rivers, rather than now where they've sort of been turned into effectively canals, you know, straightened, they would have meandered into all sorts of different streams. If you imagine other deltas that might be in your head, like the Amazonian Delta, where the river is no longer one channel, but forming into sort of multiple channels before it reaches the sea, and little islands, Isle of Ely, of course, is very famous, but the different little islands that were dry all year round, but then in the winter, when the rainfall was more heavy, they would become completely surrounded by water. In the summertime, when there's less rain, these very rich pastures would emerge. They'd been fertilised by the silt blowing down in the winter, so the natural fertilizer. So these were very rich summer pastures of grasslands. There were large meres or lakes that were permanently there, extremely rich in bird life and in fish and in eels. It's not a poor area. The old histories were told as if this was all just a sort of barren wasteland before. It's one of the richest areas in England through the Middle Ages because the natural resources, both of the summer pastures, but also of the fish, of the eels, of the feathers, the game meats, and the local people had a way of life built around this rich natural resources and the seasonal movements of birds and fish and eels in and out of the area. You have a sort of a really complex traditional economy and lifestyle that had survived invasions over many, many centuries, way of life completely adapted to the environment. That's what you would have seen, a sort of extraordinarily rich wetland. You wouldn't have felt like you were in modern England, and certainly a very, very different landscape from the fens today. You still can get glimpses, of course, of the lost landscape in certain reserves, and there's features of the land itself that I think have stayed the same. You know, the writers of the past will talk about the vast skies and the flatness of the landscape and the sense of space that you get. There's continuities there as well, but it is a transformed land. But it's always been a changing land, Lee. I think that's another piece. And it continues to be that today, sense of provisionality about it. I mean, the rivers in the old days were never really fixed. They'd shift and change their course. And this is not a land that was ever fixed in time. In a sense, that's one thing that hasn't changed.
And because they lived and worked on this land, as you alluded to, it gave them a particular identity, which you've described in the book as Fenish. This identity is very communal, isn't it? I mean, I think you say something like, the sharp distinction between self, community and land that is now embedded in the Western mind did not exist in the Fenish world.
I mean, the common system is something that's really hard for us to get our head around. It's not centred on the individual, not centred on title deeds that this is my land and it's not yours. For the commoners, the land is part of who they are. It's part of their communal identity. You belong to the land in a way that it's very difficult for us to comprehend now. So I try and sort of convey a little bit of that depth of belonging that's been lost. And that's why they fought the drainage so hard. The central government, in partnership with some big investors, had the vision of draining this country and turning the people into tenant farmers, where they'd pay rent and they'd farm their little blocks and that would be their land. For the local people, it's the end of their whole culture. I don't want to push the comparison too far, but there's some real similarities there with what happens to Indigenous people in other parts of the empire. They were being dispossessed of their land, and even new colonisers were brought in. New tenant farmers were brought in. A lot of the time it wasn't local people. It was actually tenant farmers from Northern Europe. This is in the 16, 1700s, at the same time, of course, that Britain is colonising parts of the New World.
Oh, thank you, James. Hold that thought, because we'll come back to drainage and find out a little bit more about that, because that battle is at the heart of your book. Let's stay in the past now and hear from Jane Taylor. Jane Taylor is a journalist and has taught news writing and the history of journalism at a number of universities. She completed an MA in creative writing at the University of East Anglia, and in 2006 was runner-up in the Longbarn Books competition for first-time writers. Her debut novel, Over Here, was published in 2014, and her second, The Spinning House Affair, came out in May this year. And when I spoke to Jane, I asked her to tell me what it's about.
Well, it's about a rather unusual scandal, which was fermenting in Cambridge in the 1890s. And the heart of my story is the looming presence of the spinning house itself. This was a university-owned building, once a workhouse, near the centre of town. The university was using it for, if you can believe it, locking up local women suspected of soliciting. Such unfortunates could be locked up there for 3 weeks at a time. And astonishingly, it was completely legal. With such an easy, uneasy situation in mind, I've drawn together a group of mainly young people who become embroiled in the spinning house affair when it finally erupts.
So was the spinning house a real thing, and how much of this is true?
It was a real thing. There was a stink. It did come to a head. It was resolved. But my story is pure fiction.
there was a building, was there, where women were,
yes,
were sent
was.
To?
Yes, I'll tell you exactly where it was. It was next to the old police station. So it was quite near to the centre of town.
And women of, what, ill repute would be sent there, or just women who behaved badly?
Let's bear in mind first, you know, that at the turn of the 20th century, men vastly outnumbered women, outrageously so in Cambridge at the time. And there was a problem with prostitution, undeniably. It was rife. And that's precisely when the trouble starts. I set out to explore what might happen to a wrongly arrested housemaid when her reputation is all she has. I asked what happens to the head porter's daughter, who's been kept virtually a prisoner on account of her dangerously good looks, or the female student who will not be entitled to a degree. That was some way off. And the naive daughter of the newspaper proprietor and the head reporter's fiancé pressing him to achieve the scoop, which might enable them to marry at last, not to mention the brazen local madam who seems to be getting away with everything so far. So, you see, the tensions experienced by these young people weren't necessarily as black and white as they may seem on the surface.
And the tensions experienced by young people at this period of time, did they remind you of tensions experienced by young people today? Are there things that we can extrapolate from that experience?
Oh, very much. Very, very much so. Misogyny was endemic at the time in a way that was not like it is today, but it was endemic. And it became a major theme during the academic year during which this particular tale unfolds. You see, there were far too many completely innocent Me Toos out there, and all of them, absolutely all of them, without a voice of any kind. So I think that in a way is the main thing, and it's quite pressing.
And this was a time when the university held complete sway. I mean, it wasn't just an academic power, it had political power as well.
It certainly did. Over all sorts of economic aspects of the town. This is where another theme arises, which is to do with how I actually came across this story in the first place. I was teaching at a university. I was teaching journalism in the university, and I wanted to research how local papers were responding to the beginning of what was called the new journalism of the time, which was really a forerunner of the whole populism of the popular press in the 20th century. But the question that I wanted to ask was, well, how did local papers fit into this? And of course, they were somewhat behind the trend. So it took a long time for there to be any sense of campaigning about this dreadful issue. But when it did happen, that's when the whole thing began to erupt.
What kind of research did you do there? What were your sources of research for this novel?
Well, I headed off to Cambridge, which is never an excuse to do, because I grew up in Cambridge and went to school there, and I love the place to bits. So off I went. And the most useful research actually was in Cambridge Library. There are archives of materials to do with, you know, issues in the town. And the staff there were absolutely amazing, as was an archivist at one of the colleges too, who described to me in more detail, really, just how restricted people were with curfews and with this draconian policing by the proctors at the time out on the streets of Cambridge.
And when you're writing about a real place, I mean, even though we're looking at it in the past, how true do you feel you have to stay to the geography and the layout of the city?
I mean, I was entranced by it, and particularly as I've seen big changes over the years in Cambridge. It's a rich place now. It used to be a rather provincial sort of, well, market town. You know, I was immediately drawn in, and one particular feature was the presence of the river, which was an absolute stinking mess because it was the sewer of the place. And I don't know whether you remember pre the Kite development, but that whole Chesterton area was an area of awful slums, which showed the town to be in itself one not of just two parts, university and town, but of poor, desperately poor people. It's not hard to imagine how people were drawn into the ease of earning a living through prostitution. So there are two issues in the town. They don't like it. They feel uncomfortable with prostitution, but they also feel uncomfortable with the fact that women can be banged up in this spinning house by the university. That's very central to the story, I think.
And The Spinning House Affair by Jane Taylor is published by Thunderpoint Publishing. We're talking on Bookmark today to James Boyce about his book Imperial Mud, The Fight for the Fens. James, we're talking before the interview with Jane about drainage and the battle for the land, how it wasn't just a land grab as far as the Fenish people were concerned. It was an attack on their identity and their way of life. Why did people want to drain the Fens? Why couldn't they just say, well, we'll take the land and work it as it is? What was so important about draining it? Why did they need to do that?
Well, the resources of the common are very hard to sort of effectively privatise, if you like. I mean, this is the beginning of the capitalist economy emerging, so that there's large amounts of capital that are looking for a return on capital. They're looking to make money. Now, the resources of this common system, which is supporting thousands of people in a way of life, it's hard to extract the surplus from that. The big monasteries in the Middle Ages would certainly collect their, often in eels and other forms of payment. But for the, if you like, these early capitalists in the 17th century are looking for opportunities. And also in the 17th century, it's also the central state is looking for a revenue source. They can enclose the land, which means remove the common rights. They turn it into what we would understand as private property. So that the owner of the land is the only one who has the rights to use the land and control the land. That they can drain it and enclose it, then they can rent it out to tenant farmers and get this regular income from it. It's basically a way of privatising the common wealth and appropriating the wealth of the land into a few hands and turning people into either dependent wage labourers or into tenant farmers. The motivation is to make money. Initially, the Stuart kings, who are cash-strapped, are the biggest promoters of the Fen drainage. But they need partners in these, some of these big landowners join them as partners in the project. It's basically about making money, to put it simply, Lee.
But you explain this paradox that exists, that when you drain the land, it becomes more intensive in terms of what you need for its upkeep.
Yes. What they hadn't expected, they drained the land in partnership with the Dutch in the 17th century, because the Dutch, as we all know, are the drainers of land, but they didn't understand that what they had to learn was that the Fens actually was different from Holland, in that the peat soil, once it was drained, starts to decompose essentially. Some of it gets eroded and compressed as well, but the main loss of soil is from the peat. Once it's exposed to dry air, once it dries out, the soil starts to shrink. This area, instead of being slightly above sea level or at sea level, increasingly sinks below sea level. It subsides. Initially, they were just relying on gravity to drain it by straightening the rivers and building the canals. And then they had to bring in windmills because, of course, to get water from below sea level, you need to pump it in some way. And so they brought in windmills. That sort of worked for a while. But through the 18th century, as more and more peat was lost, the windmills increasingly struggled to keep up, and a lot of areas went back to being wetland, actually. And it was really only the coming of steam power in the early 19th century where the drainage was fully affected. But there was always a sense, right through to the present day, there's a sense of provisionality about this, in the sense that as more soil gets lost, the energy cost of removing the water gets higher. Of course, the fertility of the soil also goes down. So what was initially metres and metres of peat is reduced, and so you don't get the same output. This goes right through to the present, this equation between the cost of keeping it dry and the return that you get from it. And in the 18th century, they had to learn again to sort of let some areas go back to being water, learn how to live with the waters a bit. This is what farmers and water managers and government authorities and conservation groups are working on again today, how to live with the waters and not just fight them. And that's been the ongoing struggle. And it seemed like technology would end this, that the mastery of humans would win out. But in a sense, what's been going on for centuries and centuries and centuries, that human beings have to learn to live with this environment. That's a really interesting part of the whole story as well, because the traditional knowledge is something that had its own economic value as well.
Well, let's take a break for some music now. Let's hear your second choice of music, which is Mystery by Bruce Cockburn. Why this one?
This is a song that's quite important to me. It's perhaps an odd song, but there's so much in life as we get older that we can't fully explain. And as I get older, I realise that it's a story, and I'm really dealing largely with what is not known. The amount that we know is quite small. You know, we just get these little slivers of the past and we try and work to keep the story alive. And I think that that's true for a lot of us in our own lives as we get older. We realise that the amount that we actually know for sure perhaps gets less, not more in some ways, and we learn to live with mystery. And so this song by the wonderful Canadian singer-songwriter Bruce Cockburn, it does say a lot, I think, about what it means to be a historian and also just to be a human being.
You can't tell me there is no mystery, mystery, mystery. You can't tell me there is no mystery, it's everywhere I turn. Moon over junkyard where the snow lies.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Cambridge Breakfast with Julian Clover and Lucy Milazzo.
It's the breakfast show that's all about Cambridge. We've got the news.
National and local.
Travel updates.
From the A14 to Milton Bode and all stations to Cambridge.
The people and the places.
Plus guests in our Friday food club.
Cambridge Juice.
All the new things to do in the city.
Our daily quiz.
Oh yes, questions, questions with Lucian.
And all request Jukebox Friday.
And don't forget the coffee.
Cambridge Breakfast with Julian Clover and Lucy Milazzo.
Here with a fresh blend weekday mornings from 7.
What's in your spare room? Christmas decorations? Maybe an old exercise bike? Could you give that room to a young person along with a fresh start? St Christopher's Fellowship is looking for people to become foster carers in Cambridgeshire to provide safe, caring homes for teenagers who need help. And because we've been working to improve young people's lives since 1870, you can trust that you're not on your own. You'll receive regular training, dedicated social worker support, and space to share experiences with other carers. It's more than a spare room, it's a brighter future. Call 0800 234 6282 or visit stchris.org.uk/fostering. St Christopher's, creating brighter futures.
Hi, Pam here. Are you tired of the same old shops? Drop into Fantasia on Mill Road near Parker's Peace. Enter our treasure cave full of fine clothing and exotic homewares. Natural materials, uplifting ambiance, mood improvement guaranteed. Perk up your wardrobe, your home, your life. Dare to shop different. Fantasia, 64 Mill Road, Cambridge. Fantasia.uk.com.
For opening times, please see fantasia.uk.com.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our featured guest on Bookmark today is James Boyce, talking about his book, Imperial Mud, The Fight for the Fens. James, talking before the music there about working as a historian, how did you research this particular book? Because I'm guessing that the communities that you're writing about, there weren't many written records about what was going on in those communities.
Well, yes and no. By historical standards, there's actually a fair bit. The story gets tangled up in the Civil War. So, of course, there's a lot written about that. And the drainage of the Fens become quite central to the whole Civil War drama and its aftermath. Cromwell, of course, from the Fens. And the resistance to the drainage and the resistance to the enclosure is one of the parliamentary causes early on. But then later on, really, Cromwell sort of betrays the commoners, at least in Cambridgeshire, not so much in Lincolnshire, where the people pushing the drainage were royal supporters. Basically, what I mean is at this time, it's very much tangled up with these fierce ideological and physical fights that's going on. It's a battle of ideas as well as a battle on the ground. And so there's quite a lot of material at point. Lots of pamphlets written on both sides supporting the drainage and those against the drainage. After that, I mean, at different periods, the amount of material varies, but most of these conflicts are fairly well documented. And one of the things I've learned from Frontier here is not to put resistance into this narrow category. Like, resistance takes many forms. And one of the forms it takes in the Fens is the use of the courts and appeal to parliamentary processes, to royal protection and to different landlords. People use very many different forms of protest. It's not always just sabotaging drainage works in the middle of the night through sort of guerrilla warfare action, even though that does go on. I mean, people die in this struggle. There's court records, there's parliamentary records, there's parliamentary inquiries. There's books written, the songs, resistance songs. It's a story that mainly is unfolding in the post-printing press age when pamphlets are being used. And as I say, it's an ideological battle. It's a battle of ideas. It's one side needs to show that the Fens is a barren waste and the Fenlanders as sort of near savages, people who are just indolent and heathen. And the other side is wanting to demonstrate the wealth of this area and the environmental and economic benefits of the current system and also the cultural life of the people, you know. It's a struggle that is actually relatively well documented.
And it's called Imperial Mud, and one of the central arguments is about the fight to control it and the expansion of the crown and the state coincided or reinforced the colonialism that was taking place overseas and British expansion and imperialism. That argument, that idea, when did that come to you? Was that always there? Had you always thought that, or was it, did the research suggest it to you?
The whole enclosure movement, which is so massive across England that stretches over hundreds of years, that's often presented as a sort of precursor to colonisation. In a sense, the ordinary English people get dispossessed in their own country first. Then, having been dispossessed, a lot of these people become the colonisers. They lose their rights to land in England and then become colonisers in North America, you know, in Australia and elsewhere. But in the research for the book, I became really increasingly aware that it's contemporaneous. It's actually happening at the same time. The processes of empire, the increasing power of the centralised state, and the dispossession of people from the land and the new understanding of land ownership, this process is so similar to what's happening 100 miles from London as what was happening in Tasmania, where I'm sitting now. Now, of course, there are profound differences as well. I mean, the fact that we're dealing with English people does make a big difference, but it doesn't make as much of a difference as I think it's often assumed. If you're losing your whole livelihood, your whole community, you've been dispossessed of your whole form of economic security, but also your communal identity, your place in the world, your whole cultural framework's disappearing. It is different if you're English, but we shouldn't exaggerate that difference. I mean, these people are becoming dispossessed and losing everything in a sense and fighting for everything. So there's similarities and differences, but it's part of the imperial story. As I carried on with the research, increasingly I saw the whole thing as part of one story, not just a precursor to the overseas empire, but actually part of the one story.
Thank you, James. Well, let's just move now from the watery Fens to Egypt and hear from Raphael Cormack. Raphael is an award-winning editor and translator and has written on Arabic culture for the London Review of Books and elsewhere. Midnight in Cairo, The Female Stars of Egypt's Roaring Twenties is his first book. It tells the story of Egypt's interwar nightlife and entertainment industry through the lives of its pioneering women. Marina Warner called it beguiling and original, and Kirkus Review described it as a lively and original story of modern Egypt told through the lives of its first generation of women celebrities. When I spoke to Raphael, I asked him first when he'd realised that there was a story to be told.
It was probably when I was living in Cairo. So, I mean, I first went to Cairo in 2009 to learn Arabic, and I studied for my PhD. I did my fieldwork there on Egyptian theatre, and I was living downtown in Cairo in the same area where all of this entertainment scene had been in the 1920s and 30s. and you can kind of see the traces of it. But as I was looking into Egyptian theatre, actually my PhD was in adaptations of Oedipus, so a slightly more refined topic than the one that this book's about. But yeah, I found out about this whole nightlife scene that had been there in the same place, basically, that where I was living. And through that, I just started digging around in all these old entertainment magazines, which are in Egyptian libraries, and found all of these fantastic stories of particularly the women who ran the nightclubs and the theater troupes, and who were the great singing stars. And just coming across that, I just kept digging further and further. I sort of couldn't stop digging, and found all of these amazing stories, which I've tried to sort of weave together through the lives of some of these, the most important women of the period.
I think that's probably the surprise, that it's women who are leading the way here, because we have an image of the Middle East as, well, repressive towards women. And yet these were real pioneers, weren't they?
Yeah. And, it, you know, in the 1920s as well, if you look at the political world and the sort of high literary world, it's extremely male. I mean, you see pictures of various groups, they take photos of themselves, and it's all men, basically a sea of men, which is why it was so striking going through these magazines that it's women on the cover, it's women who people are most interested in, and yeah, it's women who are running the show a lot of the time. So one of the biggest cabarets of 1920s Cairo is run by a woman called Badia Masabni, who was actually originally grew up in, was born in Damascus, then moved to Cairo, and she had financial control over what was going on, as well as a lot of creative control. I mean, there's all kinds of women like this, but yeah, it's not just women who are being seen on stage, it's women who are running the show a lot of the time.
And do these women have something in common? Is there a common element to them?
It's a huge amount of diversity in where they've come from. So some were born in Egypt, some were born in Syria, Lebanon. What I look at in the book is the Arabic-speaking women in the Arabic-speaking scene, although there was, at the same time, for instance, a French woman who ran a big French-speaking cabaret in Cairo. What is striking about a lot of the women who rose to the top is how their early lives are very similar, like very little formal education. They all come from, if not necessarily extremely poor backgrounds, definitely not wealthy backgrounds, either sort of lower middle class. Often their fathers have died. So this is a story of women who are not of the elite. And that's something that unites sort of all of them.
And this took place in the interwar years in Cairo. Is that crucial to the story? Was it a particular time?
Yeah, and the 1920s is kind of the golden age. And a lot of things come together to make it that. One is that there's a big explosion in the entertainment press. So that, you know, at the same time as this scene is rising, there are people covering it. Another is that Cairo at this time was going through a kind of boom economically, and people were coming from all over the world. So a lot of the dancers, as well as being Egyptian, came from Eastern Europe, say, came from around the Middle East to participate in the scene. Another extremely important piece of background is that Cairo has just experienced a revolution in 1919, a revolution against the British, which, with some caveats, was successful. So in the early 1920s, Egypt becomes an independent nation. Previously, it had been occupied by the British and during the First World War, run by the British. So there's this sense that the future kind of belongs to people in Egypt. They're dictating what the country is going to be like. They're dictating the state of a newly independent nation and what that will be. So people are, as well as flooding to the nightclubs, people are discussing socialism, feminism, political and cultural issues are really being debated. So there's a sense that both Cairo is booming as a city, but there are opportunities for it to move in all kinds of directions. I think that's really underpins a lot of what makes the nightlife so exciting.
And we're talking about something that took place 100 years ago. Is there any sign of that now? Is there any legacy?
There is. I mean, a lot of the legacy moved into film. So a lot of the stars of the theatre and actually of the nightclub stages in the 30s and 40s moved into cinema. And Egyptian cinema is still extremely influential, and it's one of the biggest, I mean, the biggest cinema scene in the Middle East. There are still dancers who perform, you know, share their videos on Instagram. still an active dance scene, but the actual area where all of this happened has sort of, there are a few traces, a few seedy nightclubs, one slightly more respectable nightclub, and one theatre that does still survive. But I mean, it sort of lacks the verve that it had in the 1920s, lots of abandoned places, but there's kind of people trying to pick things up. Recently, an independent cinema opened up on the same street where all of the cabarets were. In fact, in a location where some of the biggest cabarets had once been. So there's a sense that maybe things are opening, people are starting to open some things up. But if you went there today, you wouldn't see what you saw in the 1920s.
And without giving any spoilers, what happened to these women? I mean, presumably when war came along, everything changed.
Yeah, when the Second World War came along, some of these women, Badia Musubni, who we already mentioned, who ran the big nightclub in the 1920s and 30s, she really managed to cash in on the war. And she opened a new nightclub, which became the spot where soldiers on leave would come. You know, Cairo in the Second World War became this place for soldiers on leave to go and have a good time. And a lot of them went to Badia Musubni's nightclub. She put on these pro-Allied performances and really cashed in on the scene. Other women sort of faded off the radar after the great golden age of the 20s and 30s. And then after the war, there's a sort of a new generation comes along. And the last chapter in the book discusses a dancer called Taheya Carioca, because she represents this kind of new post-war generation of dancers. She's politically active in left-wing scenes, but then she has a run-in with the new government in Egypt. So in 1952, a new government takes control, a new nationalist government. There's a coup and the Free Army officers take control. Again, like in 1919, there's this big sense that things could change. But a lot of people, after a few years, began to become disillusioned with the government. And Taheya Carioca, who was in the late 40s and early 50s, one of the greats of the new generation of dancers and politically active, is arrested and spends time in prison. So yeah, these women were not just doing things on nightclub stages. They were often involved in politics.
And what's next for you? What are you writing now?
I'm working on a book currently, which is more similar to this book than it sounds, but on the history of spiritualism in the 20s and 30s as well. I mean, I'm very interested by the 20s and 30s in the Middle East particularly, and this sense that I was talking about of new possibilities and the opportunity for change really arising in the Middle East. And I think spiritualism is another big part of that. Something that people don't know very much about, I don't think, but there's lots of people in the Arab world exploring seances and communication with the dead and how that affects their own lives and relates to Islam and more traditional beliefs in the Arab world. And plus, there's still a lot of fun stage shows of hypnotists and fakirs who bury themselves alive for days and that kind of thing.
And Midnight in Cairo, The Female Stars of Egypt's Roaring Twenties by Raphael Cormack, is published by Saki Books. We've been talking on Bookmark today to James Boyce about his book, Imperial Mud, The Fight for the Fens, published by Icon Books. James, as I said, I very much enjoyed reading the book. I couldn't help feeling sad at the end of it because a way of life has been lost.
Yes.
That it's
yeah.
We can't reclaim, we can't return to this land. But looking ahead to the future, how optimistic do you feel about the future for the Fens?
I think it's a really, really important place, not just for the region and not just for England, really for the world at the moment, because we're having to learn to adapt to this extraordinary process that's underway in the changing of the climate and the changing of the environment. And we're having to learn how to live with this land, with our planet, in a new way. And people of the Fens have always had to do that. Even through the drainage, it was only really an illusion that became clear fairly quickly that technology had mastered the environment, that humans had completely triumphed. It's evident right through the history of the Fens of the need to work with the land, to adapt to the land, to learn to live with the waters. And now in the current situation with sea level rise and with continued peat loss, and high energy costs to keep the land dry, possibly lower, you know, agricultural subsidies with leaving from the EU. There's really a sort of imperative to get this right in the Fens is urgent and immediate. And now, you know, in some areas are already being returned to waters. The traditional knowledge has been drawn on to sort of learn how to manage some of these areas. And also scientific knowledge, there's a lot of study being done. And these partnerships, you know, like the Great Fen Project, different bodies working together, including farms. It's not a case of humans abandoning the scene. Humans are central to this landscape and to its survival. So I think what's happening in the fens of working this through is really what we've all got to do.
And going back to that quote that we heard right at the beginning of the show, somebody describing your book as a warning about what happens when the rich and powerful dress up their avarice as progress, a lesson we could do with learning today. That was from Country Farm magazine. What are the lessons that we can learn from what happened to the fens in the past?
The rediscovery of the common is so important now. The idea that we're all in relation to each other and we're all in relationship to the land, and that this commonwealth, if you like, is so much bigger than just narrowly defined private property returns on capital, has become essential. And there's a lot of people reflecting on what the common means in the 21st century and how we protect the common, how we restore the common, and how we restore our relationship with each other and how we restore the relationship with the land. And there's so many lessons from the fens and the thousands of years of human history in what, you know, what was until quite recently this vast, rich common that was supporting thousands of Indigenous people in a sustainable way of life. It's not that we can just return to the past, but we can draw inspiration and strength from that ancestral experience, and as much we can learn from that.
And a question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment, James?
Oh, that is such an interesting question, because I'm going on holiday to a place called Sisters Beach in northern Tasmania. It's winter here, of course, so it'll be quite cold. And Tasmania is the southernmost part of Australia, so we do have proper winters. And the forecast is not too good next week. So I actually went and bought a few books today, thinking next week is going to be a reading week for me. I'm going to read, it sounds a bit heavy, but a biography of Carl Jung. I've been interested in learning more about Carl Jung recently. He's a fascinating figure of the 20th century. And so I've sort of just started that, and I'll probably finish that first and then get on to a sort of lighter novel, I think, after that.
Thank you, James. We'll come back to you in just a moment to find out about your last choice of music. But heads up that our next show featured guest is Elodie Harper, talking about her novel, The Wolf Den. We'll hear from poet Ian McMillan on his collaboration with musician Hella Phonics. And journalist Terry McAllister will be chatting about his book, Crude Britannia, a look at how oil has shaped Britain's past and present. But before we sign out, let's hear your last choice of music, James. This Land Is Your Land by Woody Guthrie. I think I know why you've chosen this, but I'm contractually obliged to ask, why did you choose this piece of music?
Well, Woody, you know, used to wander around America, and This Land Is Your Land is sometimes used by wing Americans as a sort of nationalistic song. But in fact, Woody, of course, wrote it as completely opposite to that, that the sense that land can't be owned by any one person, really. I mean, we're all just at most custodians of the land. This land is your land. This land is my land. It's all of our land. Land ownership really is an illusion of the modern age. So it's a celebration of the common in some ways.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for